him. And His Eminence Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the 10th divinely appointed Imam, the 10th divinely appointed successor, and the 10th divinely appointed trustee of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. During the imamah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, the Abbasid Caliph Mutawakkil had the most bitter enmity against Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. And this was due to the special respect and honor that was given to Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Mutawakkil Abbasi imposed a severe house arrest upon the 10th divinely appointed Imam. He monitored all his activities, he pinpointed his followers, and prevented legal dues from coming to Imam al-Hadi. He even tried his best to prevent scholars and narrators from associating with the divinely appointed Imam. Unfortunately, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam suffered a lot during the reign of Mutawakkil Abbasi.
Parts of Ziyara text of Jamaatul Kabira issued by Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabihit tuja wa a'lamit tuqa wa dawin nuha.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call, and the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala mahal.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's Prophet, and the progeny of Allah's Messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are humbly speaking about the beautiful conversations and dialogues of the 10th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. So there's this interesting conversation again, and again, it is these very seemingly harsh statements that come from Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam against a group of Sufis. So a group of Sufis had come into the masjid, then they went to a corner of the masjid and they began to say and sing, La ilaha illallah, there is no God but Allah. And it was at this point that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he turns towards his companions and he starts to speak to them as the companions were looking over at these Sufis, and they probably thought that, well, you know, this is a kind of Islam or something like that. The first part of the conversation and the statements of Imam al-Hadi were spoken about in a previous episode. In this episode, we want to continue and finish off what Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam says. And so when he was talking about this situation, he says that nobody follows these Sufi individuals except those that are ignorant, and no one believes in them except the foolish. Whoever went to visit any of them, alive or dead, it's as if he went to visit shaitan and idolaters. And whoever supported any of them, shaitan or idolaters, it is as if they supported Muawiyah, Yazid, and Abu Sufyan. So these are very hard statements that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam makes against the Sufis. Now, we don't want to think that these Sufis are the same Sufis that we have in the modern era, even though the teachings, at least some of the teachings, are sourced in these original Sufis. But in the era of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, you had this pseudo-Sufism and this pseudo-asceticism, which were innovations in the religion which hadn't been seen before and were really doing a lot of damage to the societal, moral, ethical, and religious fabric of the society. And all of a sudden, one of the companions, he says to Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, even if they acknowledge your haqq, they acknowledge your rights of being imams. And Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam then scolded the individual. He says, do not say that. One who acknowledges our rights does not disobey us. Do you know that they are the worst group of Sufis? Though all Sufis are dissentient to us and their way is contrary to ours, they are but the Christians and the Maji of this nation. They do their best to put out the light of Allah with their mouths, and Allah will not consent save to perfect His light, though the unbelievers are averse. And so again, here, one last statement, despite this idea of the Sufis and these things, the point that we want to take home with us is that those who acknowledge the imama and the wilaya of the infallible imams, they do not disobey the infallible and immaculate imams. And so we must, in our lives, do our best to not disobey the immaculate and infallible imams, which means to not disobey the Messenger of Allah, to not disobey the Holy Quran, and to not disobey the Almighty Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters. Erdogan arrived in Sochi on the eve of the G20 summit. This was his first visit to Russia since his re-election in May. The Turkish official began the meeting with his Russian counterpart by expressing gratitude for Moscow's assistance in extinguishing forest fires and also efforts in eliminating the consequences of a powerful February earthquake. The two sides continued with the topic of the gas hub, which is also their common project. But it was clear that the topic of Ukraine and the grain deal were the main items on the agenda of Recep Tayyip Erdogan in the trip.
We are determined to continue efforts to establish lasting peace, stability and prosperity in our region. We previously hosted the direct negotiations between the conflicting parties. As before, we are ready to do our best and act as a mediator.
Erdogan arrived on the eve of the G20 summit in New Delhi. Therefore, the issue of the grain deal was also raised, from which Russia withdrew, since not a single promise given by the Western partners was fulfilled. Putin noted that the withdrawal of Russia does not affect the food crisis. In addition, Russia is ready to come up with several initiatives at once.
We intend to organize the supply of 1 million ton of grain from Russia at a preferential price for processing to Turkey and then free transportation to the poor countries. In this sense, we count on the help from the Qatari state, who is ready to support the poorest countries for humanitarian reasons.
According to the Russian leader, the initiative is not a replacement for the grain deal, but would make a great contribution to solving the food problem in the African countries. The visit by the Turkish president turned out to be quite short, just a few hours, and no documents were signed.
Turkey's hopes to extend the grain deal did not come true. However, Moscow and Ankara are already engaged in several joint projects. Russia is building the Akuyu nuclear power plant, and the state of the gas hub, which diversifies Russian gas supplies to Europe, also depends on Moscow. Russia is actively supporting Turkey in various sectors of the national economy, ranging from banking to metallurgy. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Tensions remain high in Sweden after the Holy Quran was desecrated in the city of Malmö on Sunday. A notorious Iraqi hate preacher has been attacking Islam's holy text on a routine basis for weeks. His antics led to an angry response as 15 people were arrested following confrontations with the police. Police provided protection for the offensive action and even arrested some Muslims who tried to save the Quran from the flames. Cities up and down Sweden are all being affected by these anti-Islam incidents. This mosque in central Stockholm has routinely been the victim of Quran desecration antics, many of which have been taking place right outside their front doorsteps and with police protection at that. The Muslim world has responded angrily, trying to pressure the Swedish authorities to curb this rising trend in Islamophobic stunts. A local Swedish Muslim activist explained how the government's defense of hate speech is costing Sweden dearly.
Almost majority of Swedish people, they don't like these actions, you know, because this will destroy Swedish reputation in the world. And this kind of acts may hurt milliards of Muslims all over the world. So to let this thing just happen in this country, we almost see that the Finland, like for example, and even Denmark right now, they are studying the things that they will prohibit the burning of Quran. So why cannot Sweden do that?
Though acknowledging that these acts hurt Sweden's image and put its security at risk, the authorities here have shown no concrete signs of changing the laws to protect Muslims from hate preachers. Swedish security services have also admitted the country's security situation has deteriorated following the Quran burnings. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Arbaeen is one of the largest religious gatherings in the world, commemorating the 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. People of various nationalities, including Afghans, are marching toward the holy city of Karbala in Iraq.
I am one of those longing to walk to the holy shrine of Imam Hussein and his companions in Karbala. I just registered in a caravan today. I can't wait for the arrival of Arbaeen and the chance to fulfill my dream of joining the march.
I am very glad that I am going on this trip to Karbala. I thank Iran and Iraq for facilitating the granting of our visas. We are all joining the Arbaeen march, and I pray that God blesses all lovers of Imam Hussein in this journey.
Religious experts say that Arbaeen is a demonstration of Shia Muslims' unity and their commitment to their sacred values. They believe it's not only a religious duty, but also a political statement.
Arbaeen is one of the most important and valuable occasions for freedom seekers and those who follow the school of Ashura. It's a way of showing their loyalty to the values and principles that Imam Hussein defended, such as justice, dignity, and freedom. It's also a way of resisting the tyranny and oppression that they face from arrogant powers.
According to experts, the participation of Shia Afghans in the Arbaeen March is proof of their resilience and devotion in the face of adversity and oppression. It also highlights their goal of preserving their religious identity and traditions.
The Arbaeen March is a spiritual journey to the holy city of Karbala. Afghan Muslims join pilgrims from other countries to renew their allegiance to Imam Hussein and his thoughts. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan has paid a visit to the Islamic Republic of Iran upon the invitation of his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian. In a meeting, the two ministers discussed the possibilities for further advancing bilateral cooperation in all fields and to exchange views on current regional and international developments. Activating the Joint Economic Cooperation Commission, strengthening political synergy, following up on neighborhood cases and consultation on regional security issues have been among areas of talks between Iran-Turkey diplomatic delegations.
We've discussed the implementation of the comprehensive plan for long-term cooperation between Tehran and Ankara that was concluded during Mr. Erdogan's visit to Tehran. The agreements between the two presidents are on the right track. We also reviewed plans to increase the annual trade volume to 30 billion euros, and good arrangements have so far been made to achieve that target.
Negotiations have been held in Tehran about the efforts to ensure security along the common border, fight against terrorism, facilitate transportation, and raise the value of trade exchanges. We are delighted about the reconciliation between Tehran and Riyadh. Turkey, Iran, and Saudi Arabia are responsible countries in the region. We call for the improvement of bilateral ties with Tehran through tangible mechanisms. We believe the two countries should fight terrorism in the region as powerful allies.
The Turkish official's visit to Tehran comes after his trip to Moscow. According to analysts, in view of the two countries' current trade volume of almost $15 billion, the volume of political exchanges between Iran, Turkey and Russia is increasing. And this indicates the will of the Tehran-Ankara-Moscow triangle to raise the level of cooperation and resolve some regional cases diplomatically.
Collaboration and synergy regarding Syria, mutual efforts to neutralize sanctions and pressures against both countries, and joint planning to deal with illegal immigrants are some of the areas in which Iran and Turkey have common interests that can bring both nations closer. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Remembering a national hero, a symbol of resistance. Many Iranians this year are marking the National Day against British colonialism at the resting place of a man who organized a popular resistance movement against British troops that had invaded Iran in 1915. Rais Ali Dilvari's martyrdom anniversary has fallen just days before Arbaeen, allowing pilgrims who are taking part in the Arbaeen walk to mark the occasion at his resting place in Wadi As-Salam Cemetery in the Iraqi city of Najaf, where the pilgrimage begins.
Rais Ali Dilvari was a hero just like Martyr Qasem Soleimani in our days. Actually, as Iranians, I think we're lucky that we had quite a number of these freedom fighters. For example, the Jangad movement of Gilan and the Tangistanis who formed the main resisting power against the British Empire in southern Iran.
We know that he was a young man living in the city of Dilvar in Bushehr province, and he successfully fought against the British invaders. That is why we have to keep his memory alive and educate our young generation about him.
Martyr Rais Ali Dilvari played an important role in the fight against colonialism.
As Iranians, we owe him our independence and freedom.
Rais Ali Dilvari was born in 1261 in Dilvar in Bushehr. After the sudden entrance of British forces into the southern province in 1915, he led the Iranian army in their fight against British colonialists. Rais Ali Dilvari was ultimately killed by Anglo-Indian forces following months of bloody clashes. Today, his home has been turned into a museum and registered as a national heritage in Iran. And to commemorate him, his martyrdom anniversary, which usually falls on the 3rd of September, is marked on the Iranian calendar as a national day of fight against British colonialism.
Decades after his martyrdom, Rais Ali Dilvari is still an inspiration, not just for Iranians, but for freedom fighters worldwide. Gisum Shahmadi, Wadi As-Salam Cemetery, Najaf.
On Friday, trade and base unions held a nationwide strike over what they call a shameful number of deaths at work. On Wednesday, five maintenance workers were hit by a train while repairing tracks on the Milan-Turin line in northern Italy. The day after, two more workplace fatalities occurred, bringing the total number of deaths on the job to over 700 since January. Unions are saying these tragedies could have been avoided.
Yes, these deaths could have been prevented. As safety in the workplace costs money, companies prefer to save on worker safety this way, making bigger profits. Our railway system was in the hands of the state until not long ago. Today, most of it has been contracted to private firms. Private groups only know how to offer services at the cheapest rate. It's like a rat race. If workers complain about their working conditions, they are fired.
On Friday, prosecutors placed under investigation an employee of the National Rail Company, RFI, in relation to the accident in which five maintenance workers were hit and killed by a train. Safety in the workplace is an issue of increasing concern in Italy. According to the European Union's statistical agency Eurostat, 776 fatal accidents on the job were recorded in Italy in 2020. By far the highest number in the block.
On top of the deaths at work, we also have a high number of non-fatal accidents and practically no protection for workers on very demanding physically and psychologically jobs. Private companies must be given strict rules when doing workplace safety risk assessments, and their managers have to be severely punished when they fail to observe these rules.
Unions are demanding that the workplace safety issue seriously enter the political debate and that the country's work system finally comply with the EU safety standards. Max Civili, Rome.
On Friday, Amir Abdullahian met with Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah, Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri, and caretaker Foreign Minister Abdullah Abu Habib, both sides discuss the latest developments as well as challenges facing Lebanon on various levels. The issue of Saudi-Iranian rapprochement seemed to be a significant additive, which experts believe could prove constructive.
Any rapprochement between the countries of the region is in the interest of Lebanon. Saudi-Iranian agreements are a positive step, and they benefit the entire region. And they confront the U.S. ambitions and interests. We know very well that it was the U.S. that opposed this reconciliation, and they always stand against any rapprochement between any two countries in the region.
Iranian experts say Tehran's goal is to have a wider scope of cooperation in the region for the sake of mutual understanding among regional states.
Iran wants to use its bilateral relations with different countries in the region in order to create a multilateral format for cooperation. For example, to work with Saudi Arabia on helping Lebanon or helping Syria or helping Yemeni issue. The vision which is aimed by Iran is strengthening these bilateral and multilateral cooperation against any external interference in the region.
Iran's foreign minister has stressed that Tehran will not hesitate to provide Beirut with any necessary need, but without any interference in Lebanon's internal affairs. Iran's foreign minister has always stressed in all his visits that the election of a president is an internal Lebanese issue. He also suggested that a positive Saudi perspective toward Lebanon could help break the deadlock in the presidential crisis. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Netherlands and Denmark are the only EU nations so far to have supplied F-16 warplanes to fight the Russian army. Ukraine Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba told his EU counterparts on Thursday that more countries need to follow suit. He also claims sanctions against Moscow are being circumvented and need to be tightened up.
We should deprive Russia of the capacity to produce missiles and drones. We see that the production is increasing and they use Western elements, Western spare parts in it.
Experts say EU sanctions against foreign nations are set to become even less effective as groupings like BRICS expand further.
They see it as a momentum to say, OK, this is payback time. We are going to show the world that we are capable to build a strong, unified bloc together with Saudi Arabia, Iran, United Arab Emirates. This bloc, if it is well managed and well elaborated on, has a huge potential.
EU defence ministers have been told to ramp up their training of Ukrainian soldiers.
I still think that we have to do more and faster. And I propose the ministers to raise the objective of the mission to 40,000 Ukrainian soldiers trained by the end of the year.
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban insists Ukraine cannot defeat Russia. As an EU member, Hungary says it will block a proposed 20 billion euro financial package for Ukraine. Orban wants peace talks. Many others do too, as the EU is faced with a growing social crisis. Anti-war campaigners say it is disgraceful that the EU is now in an arms race with NATO, claiming the bloc has moved from being a peace project to a full-scale military operation. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Over 600 Sunni clerics, scholars and thinkers from different parts of Iran took part in a meeting with Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to share their thoughts on the issues facing the Muslim world. The meeting was held on the occasion of the Government's Week in Iran. Addressing the meeting, Iran's president said a united Muslim society is the biggest obstacle to global arrogance.
An organized, coherent and united society moves towards a clear and purposeful destination. Having goals and being dynamic are the main characteristics of a nation. A united society and Islamic Ummah is the biggest obstacle to the global arrogance and the system of domination. And this is the biggest obstacle to the dominators. After World War II, when two power blocks were formed in the world, and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the hegemonic powers considered the unity of Muslims as the only obstacle to their dominance. Therefore, they always try to take measures against the Islamic world, but unity is the best solution to counter such measures.
Sunni and Shia religious scholars and elites believe that global arrogance is seeking to sow discord among Muslims by creating obstacles, launching propaganda campaign, and forming tech theory groups. But the Islamic Ummah should be vigilant to foil all the plots.
Such a meeting provides a good opportunity to offer better practical solutions for forging further unity and convergence between Shia and Sunni. The government of the Islamic Republic does not believe in any separation between Sunni and Shia Muslims. Dr. Raisi believes that both Shia and Sunni Muslims are of one essence. Accordingly, good achievements have been made in the economic, political, and social status of Sunni Muslims in the country.
Regarding the existing commonalities among different sects of Islamic schools of thought, such a gathering would send out this message to the enemy that Muslims are united and they cannot easily create discord among Shia and Sunni Muslims.
If all Muslims get united and join hands, no enemy would dare to sow the seeds of discord among them. The enemies do not want Muslims to make progress, but if we are united and support each other, the enemies cannot do anything.
The participating Iranian Shia and Sunni elites and scholars unanimously believed that what they all have in common is to think about the country's national interests and problems, which can certainly discourage the enemies.
Iranian officials and the scholars attending this event believe that creating unity among Sunni and Shia Muslims
is indeed a strategy for the Islamic Republic of Iran to help foil the plots hatched by the enemies of the Islamic world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Like dominoes, African states are one by one falling outside the shackles of neocolonialism. Chad, Guinea, Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, and now Gabon are saying no to France's long-time domination of African financial, political, economic, and security affairs. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, Berlin Conference of 1884 to 1885 was undeniably one of the biggest evil summits in modern history. Greedy and racist European colonialists sat down in the German city and divided Africans as if they were sharing bread on a breakfast table. The conference was organized by Otto von Bismarck, the first chancellor of Germany at the request of King Leopold II of Belgium, the Western genocidal barbarian that murdered more than 10 million innocent Africans in Congo. Most Africans are now even aware of this genocide in Congo perpetrated by the Belgian colonialists because it is not in the history books written by the white colonialists. European colonialism in Africa lasted more than a century, with only the ancient kingdom of Ethiopia spared because they defeated the Italian colonialists on the battlefield. Trillions and trillions of dollars were stolen from Africa. Millions of Africans were murdered by the European colonialists. And Africans were massively brainwashed that they had no history before European colonialism. The wave of independence in Africa from 1950s and 1960s did not represent true independence. What actually happened was that colonialism was cleverly replaced with neo-colonialism by the genocidal imperialist barbarians of the West. The massive looting of rich resources in Africa continued under Western puppet leadership. The courageous African leaders who refused to dance to the tune of the European colonialists were eliminated. This was what happened to African heroes Patrick Lumumba of Congo and Thomas Sankara of Burkina Faso. Congo has all mineral resources except for crude oil. The uranium used by the US regime to make the atomic bombs unleashed on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was mined in Congo. Among the European colonialists, French colonialism was more brutal and exploitative. France killed more than 1.5 million civilians in Algeria alone. They murdered tens of thousands of civilians in other African countries. One of the modus operandi of the French colonialists was to assemble Islamic scholars in a hall and exterminate all of them. They did this in Algeria, Chad, Mali, and Senegal. And the greed of their neocolonialism is extreme. Even after independence, France is still controlling the wealth of its former colonies in Africa. The rich resources of French nations are still controlled by France, and they continue to pay colonial tax to France. French goods and services dominate their markets. The domineering presence of France in these countries has been excruciating and devastating for the local populations. Niger Republic does not know the quantity of uranium France was taking from there, which is worse than slavery. There is a popular saying that no evil lasts forever. France's neocolonialism in Africa will not last forever. Popular military coups against puppets of France's imperialism have started and are gathering momentum. The recent military coup in the West African state of Niger Republic does not stand in isolation but follows similar upheavals in the neighboring countries of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Guinea in recent years. Mali is facing insurgency that is backed by Western hegemony. Mali expelled French troops because they were actively aiding the insurgents to justify its military presence in the African country. Now, we woke up with the news of another puppet of the Western hegemonic barbarians in Gabon overthrown by the military. Ali Bongo inherited the Gabon presidency from his corrupt father, Omar Bongo. Recently, some military personnel appeared on state TV and announced that they were seizing power and dislodging a family that has ruled the country for 56 years. The military officers introduced themselves as members of the Committee of Transition and the Restoration of Institutions. Today, the country is undergoing a severe institutional, political, economic, and social crisis, the officer said in a statement, dubbing the recent election illegitimate, adding, "In the name of the Gabonese people, we have decided to defend the peace by putting an end to the current regime." Pertinently, Gabon's former president had 70 bank accounts, 39 apartments, 2 Ferraris, 6 Mercedes-Benz cars, 3 Porsche and Bugatti in France. He ruled for 42 years, from 1967 to 2009. French leaders loved Bongo because he was loyal to them. His son, Ali Bongo, has been the president for 14 years. He just has been overthrown in a coup.
Dear listeners, here we interrupt the normal course of our program and go live to Press TV headquarters, where our colleagues in Press TV have provided programs on the occasion of Arba'in. Dear listeners, I'm Atefa Erfani, hosting this part of the program, and this is the live coverage of Arba'in ritual, which is the 40th day following the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Here I express my heartfelt condolences to you on this anniversary. Now we go live to Press TV to hear more about this issue.
Glorious this trek or journey or pilgrimages, but rather downplay it.
I think it's a well-known fact that in the West, anything positive or Islamically that's positive, they try to shun it or not show it. I mean, we saw this, for example, during the coverage of the Qatar World Cup when the opening ceremony, we had Quran recitation and this wasn't shown anywhere in the West. And in the similar manner, for this has been going on for a long time and you don't see any coverage in the West. How much is do people fear this? Hugely. I think this is a big. It creates fears in the hearts of everybody who not only is not pro Islam or is in Islamophobe, But fact is, anybody who supports any kind of oppression in the world, any of those people who stand with the regimes that are imperial, you know, imperialistic, and they do not want justice, watching something like this, this creates huge fear in their hearts. And of course, we saw the fact that, you know, the ISIS a few years back, we saw this was their target, and they tried everything to ensure that these kind of gatherings do not happen. COVID came in, but the reality is this did not stop. It keeps growing and growing. And of course, it is of a huge, I think, a problematic scene from the Western point of view. Having said that, I think what I find fascinating is that the amount of pilgrims going from the West to Karbala has also increased tremendously. And interestingly, it is a lot of our younger people now. On one hand, we have a lot of issues, as you know, we have a lot of issues here in the West in terms of the kind of upbringing that our children are getting, the kind of messages the education system is trying to give them to deviate them from basic tenets of Islam or even humanity. However, our young people are flocking to Karbala, and this is because I think the young people are looking for an identity, and in Imam Hussein and in these shrines, they find their identity. So how do the West look at it? With a lot of fear, I think, and they just don't know what to do about it, because despite all the efforts to suppress it, we just see it growing more and more.
Well, you made a couple important points there, and I'd like to ask you about that, Mohammed Khani. What I jotted down from what our guest there, Sakinda Tu, said, that the number of Western visitors has actually increased, which is somewhat the trend that has been going on for quite some time. Every year, you have more and more Western visitors either joining the pilgrims on this journey, or they go to Karbala direct. And also, she said the number of young people who attend this pilgrimage. And she said one of the points is for them to find their identity. If you agree with her, can you expand a little bit more on that? Because I find that to be rather fascinating, how she talked about how people can find their identity when it comes to Arba'een and, of course, this pilgrimage.
Yeah, it is definitely fascinating. And I see amongst our own youth here in Denmark, for example, people traveling to Karbala and walking the walk from Najaf to Karbala. And the numbers have just been increasing. And I've been contacted by so many from our own youth asking me, Sheikh, let's form a group and let's go with a group. And, you know, so it's getting, it's a tendency that we see that more often, and something that people get much more interested in. So the fact that they're trying to suppress it by not making any media coverage in itself, that itself just shows that they haven't been successful trying to stop the message, and how powerful the message actually is, that regardless of their efforts and the amount of money they put into trying to suffocate the movement, they've not been able to. In fact, we've seen the opposite. We've seen much more youth actually participating and joining the caravan of Karbala. Even today, we had people that were walking from another city towards the masjid, which I work in, and they did it because they couldn't be in Karbala, and the numbers are increasing, even in these local walks that people have for Arba'een, or the programs that we have for Arba'een. So it just shows how powerful of a message it actually is, and why they're trying to suppress this message by not giving any media coverage at all.
Well, there's two different things here when it comes to what you just said. Sakina Datu, our guest there, talks about the message and how it's being suppressed. But maybe you can tell us what you feel, first of all, would be one of the important messages, and also why they feel like the message needs to be suppressed. It's one thing to not have media coverage of it, or to have media coverage at a minimal, but it's another thing to try to suppress the message, because that, to me, sounds like suppression goes hand in hand with being intimidated, maybe, by the message that Islam is sending.
So I think there's two things that we need to differentiate. One is the basic mourning of Imam Hussein, which is not a problem. I mean, you know, our mosques are full, and there is no problem. We get security even from the you know, country, from the leadership. They don't mind us going into our mosques and crying and mourning and doing whatever it is that we're doing. The problem comes in when you try to equate this to any kind of a political and spiritual aspect of it. So, for example, when we speak out and take the example of Imam Hussein and Sayyidah Zainab and try to tell our youths in terms of, you know, how they need to learn from this and to stand up for the truth, not to fear any kind of regime that is oppressing people, because yes, Imam Hussein was killed. Yes, they saw a lot of difficulties. The walk that is taking place today is in honor of the ladies and the caravan of Imam Zainul Abidin that really suffered. But having suffered that way, what is the end result today? So our youths are really taking on this message and saying, when you stand up for the truth, what do you lose at the end of the day? At the most, you give up your life, but look at the legacy that you leave behind. Look at it's a forever. It's like you're living forever after this life by standing up for the truth. Now, when you equate this message to the message of Arba'in or to the message of Ashura, this starts to bring in the problem, because obviously there is a problem in terms of how these Western countries want us to look at the political sphere around the world. I mean, there are so many issues in there. Issues, for example, like the resistance in Palestine, even basic issues that happen in our own countries. For example, the whole issue of during COVID, how the pharmaceutical companies over here were using imperialism to suppress their own people. There's a lot of injustice, corruption happening even within these countries. So people, the leadership does not want this message to be equated with the message of Arba'in when there are millions of people walking and buying this. But what I really find interesting, to be honest, is, you know, this year what I've seen, which is quite interesting and different, is that this message is, despite the fact that there is efforts to suppress it, it's getting out there. And so we have had, for example, I've been invited on events that are interfaith, where our Christian brothers are coming in, and we are talking about Arba'in, we are talking about the message of Imam Hussein. Any person who loves the truth, who believes in justice, they don't have to be Muslims, they are buying so much into this. And, you know, I think one thing about the West that you have to understand is, at this stage that we are in right now, there is a spiritual vacuum in these countries. People are really yearning for something. They are looking for meanings in life, because everything is so superficial. Everything is so materialistic. They are looking, they are realizing that all the things that we gather are not giving us peace, are not giving us the happiness. So we're looking for something for our souls to be awakened. And this message of Imam Hussein that we are holding on to, this is the message of Imam Hussein that people are longing for, but they do not hear it. It doesn't reach them. So in some ways, this year, I've seen a lot of effort. For example, throughout the UK, there have been Arba'in walks arranged. So everybody, all of us are longing to be in Karbala, but if we are not, we are walking in our own countries. People are setting up mawqibs, giving out free food in the middle of London. And they are giving out this food and telling people why they are doing this and what is the message of Imam Hussein. So much as there is efforts to suppress this connection of standing up for truth and justice with Imam Hussein's mission, this mission is not being suppressed. It's getting bigger and bigger.
Well, what do you think about that, Mohammed Khani? Are we looking at a West that has lost its ways, generally speaking? Of course, we can't talk for each and every country, perhaps, but based on the way that you see the state of affairs, at least our guest there, Sakina Datu, sees it that way, and I'm sure her general approach towards that topic maybe doesn't entail each and every person in the West. But that is something that, as opposed to what we're seeing here, even the way the media is covering this, I'll read off one of the lines where it said that how hundreds of thousands, if not millions, are making this procession. And it says that this is a symbol of unity that is being sent out. Even the Western media coverage, in some respects, here and there, does say that. Has the West lost its way in the way that our guest was speaking there?
I would definitely say that they've become much more desperate than before. If they feel like they're forced to put up some media coverage or try to have some media coverage, what they do normally, they try to divert the message because they know it's a powerful message. As I mentioned, it has strong roots in human history. All our prophets, they were part of this caravan that fought against falsehood, fought against injustice and unjust rulers, and it came to a turning point with Ashura, which Arba'een is a continuation of, where Imam Hussein ﷺ, he sacrificed everything for the sake of truth and to establish the true understanding of Islam, because Islam got diverted at that time and distorted. But after Ashura, he started movement after movement, and Arba'een is a continuation of that. And obviously, any superpower or any power that fears for their own power, that fears for their own interest, especially colonizers, of course, they will be intimidated by such a message, because it's such a strong message that gives the people that are oppressed strength and courage enough even to fight against these oppressors, to fight against the colonizers. And with Imam Hussein alayhi salam as your example, then obviously you're willing, or you're ready to sacrifice everything that you have. And that itself makes a person, like, you can't make a person submit if he sees death as something which he embraces and it's positive, because he will be reunited with somebody he loves and his role model. Obviously, such a person, you can't make him submit. And that itself intimidates a lot of these oppressors around the world. But that's the social political aspect of it. I would say the other aspect of it, which the West fears a lot, is the fact that the West for years now have been promoted ideas which have completely destroyed moral values in the West or in Western countries, especially amongst their youth, where following your low desires or submitting to your low desires is something which is considered to be virtuous nowadays, unfortunately. And the message of Arba'een and the message of Ashura, where you sacrifice yourself for the greater purpose, itself shows that a person shouldn't submit to his low desires. And it's such a powerful message for the people, especially the youth, that have been living in countries where they got enough of following their low desires, and they're seeking alternative ways to live or another lifestyle which they have been presented for in Western countries. Of course, they're going to be attracted by such a lifestyle. They will find that attractive. They will find that inspiring, that you have a lifestyle where you're willing to sacrifice even your low desires for the greater purpose in life. And that itself, the change of lifestyle, and that lifestyle which Ashura brings to the youth, it's attractive. It's appealing to a lot of youth here in the West that got fed up with this lifestyle where you just submit to your low desires and throw yourself into destruction, where there's no moral, there's no greater purpose in life other than just following your low desires and, yeah, basically your hawa and nafs, as we call it in Arabic. So that itself is something that scares a lot of these individuals, because that's been the main tool for them to hold power onto the youth so they can control the youth and the next couple of generations. But if people are becoming familiar with an alternative lifestyle, the lifestyle that Ashura brings, the lifestyle that Arba'een brings, and the message of Imam Hussein alayhi salam brings to their lives, obviously they will be intimidated by such a message and that lifestyle. Hence, they will try to suppress the message of Ashura and suppress the message of Arba'een.
I got one last question over here, Sakina Datu, for you, where you mentioned imperialism and, of course, suppression. We're seeing, I think, a breakdown of imperialism. If you can draw some parallels there as to how we're seeing that and some of the events that we're seeing unfold in today's world. I think one of the most significant ones is happening in Africa in terms of the African countries who are breaking out of the shackles of French colonialism, which is a form of imperialism also. By definition, they have many similarities, obviously. But if you can draw that parallel in terms of how Imam Hussein has sent his message through to people who are being oppressed. And, of course, the other big example, which has been continuing for decades, is how the people of Palestine, for example, are being oppressed.
So, I mean, that's interesting for your question, because I am originally actually from Africa and I practiced a lot of my journalism in Africa some 10 years back. And at that time, you know, we could see that the difference between then and now that I see is huge. So during that time, I think the Africans were still buying into this whole concept of, you know, the West supporting them and the West sending aid, even though there had already been certain discussions around it. And now we see a completely different story. I mean, we see the example of South Africa leading in this, for example. South Africa, of course, we all know that has always been supportive of the Palestinian cause. However, I think around the world things are realigning. We know how things are with, Russia and China posing threats, especially after the war in Ukraine, how the world is realigning forces. People who once bought very much into the concept and the ideals of the Western imperialism are now detaching themselves and realigning, because I think it's almost like, the social media has played a huge role. I think it has everything. At one point, we used to have, for example, in this country, only official sources from where people got their messages. And now, because of social media, we can see everything. BBC, for example, can say whatever they want to say about what's happening in Palestine, but we are able to see on our phones what is the real story happening there. So the world is realigning. Africa is realigning. For example, Africans weren't very pleased, again, during the World Cup when I was there and I was watching how they were reacting in the way the West was covering the issues, for example, of LGBTQ, which is culturally an issue that Africans do not accept. So now they're starting to see a bigger picture. And even within, I think the West's biggest maybe threat is from within, because we see that people over here, even within their own nations, are not buying into this theory. The question overall, I would say, is that, the spirit that we're seeing in Karbala, every year we see this, is a huge spirit. But then somehow, unfortunately, it dies down. And that's because I think globally we lack leadership that knows how to capitalize this and to form something that is tangible and concrete and longer term. So there is a lot of potential there. People are awakened. They're still awakening. But we don't have the leadership that can tap into this and bring us all together to be able to form an alternative view of life that is not imperialistic.
Okay, I think we have time, a couple minutes left here, Mohammed Khani. The way that we're looking at these images, I've noticed that we have zoomed in on what appears to be India. There are different parts of the world where people are making this journey. What is the international scope of the way that Arbaeen is being played out in the world? Are we looking at a world that's somewhat bipolar in nature, given the fact that we're seeing so many come out in the millions, which, as we mentioned, is a symbol of unity amongst Muslims?
Thank you very much. Thank you. Bye.
This is from Mohammed Khani. Go ahead.
Yeah, so definitely you see that you have local majalis or programs for Imam Hussein and to commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the martyrs of Karbala. But that's the local ones. So each country have their own cultural way to do certain things. In Iran, they have their own cultural way to commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. Iraq, another way, and other countries that have different cultural different ways to commemorate the message of Imam Hussein, Islam, the martyrdom. But everything becomes global. Everything becomes international when they all meet up in Arbaeen or the Arbaeen Walk. And that's a beautiful point in itself, because that's the connecting point of all the different Muslims around the world, especially the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, where they meet up from Najaf to Karbala, whether you're Indian, Russian, whether you're Danish, Swedish, German, even from a lot of Western countries, they form groups and walk from Najaf to Karbala. So it is definitely something which unites all the Muslims, or at least all the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, all around the world, and to understand themselves to be a part of a greater movement and not just something which is related to or limited to a certain national identity or a certain country in the world. And that itself is basically the continuation or the turning point between Ashura and what we consider to be the reappearance of the 12th Imam, because we believe in that as Muslims as well. So basically what will happen is that you will have Ashura, and between Ashura and the reappearance of the 12th Imam, there will be a movement started working towards that. And I strongly believe that Arbaeen is that movement.
Thank you very much for that, Mohammed Khani, Islamic scholar from Copenhagen. We appreciate your comments. Sakina Atu, journalist and writer from London, thank you. And with that, we come to an end for at least this edition of our rolling coverage, which we will continue for the next few hours. We ask you to stay with us for that. For now, it's goodbye.
الناس إذا تنفس سل عنه صدر الغيور سل عنه عابس دك الفوارس ألا يموت الشعور